I'm now joined by Meb Faber, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Cambria Investment Management, who currently offers 12 ETFs, nearly $1.2 billion in assets. Of course, Meb hosts his own podcast, The Meb Faber Show. Highly recommend checking that out. He's written white papers, books. He does it all. And he's now on the line with me from El Segundo, California. Meb, Happy New Year. Welcome back to the podcast.
Happy New Year, my friend.
So look, I have decided I'm cutting right to the chase here. I'm going to put you right on the spot. Will this finally be the year international stocks turn the corner? Or is this going to be another S&P 500 show with FANG stocks and Tesla and the other U.S. mega caps continuing to dominate? What say you?
Well, let me tell you, it may look calm on the surface, and it may feel calm. The S&P, another monster year in 2021. But there seems to be a lot of churn underneath the surface. And let me explain. We're starting 2022 at one of the highest valuations ever. So in the U.S., the market cap weighted S&P, if you look at the 10-year P/E ratio, it's sitting at 40. That's only happened twice in history, 1999 and 2000. Older investors will remember those years, quite burned into their memory. And we talked on Twitter, and we looked globally. We said, what happens historically when you have those high valuations? And historically speaking, and most people think this has only happened in one or two countries, but it's happened in dozens, the historical future returns for the next decade, real returns are zero on average. Now, people always say, well, it could be different with the U.S. And I say, well, you know, there's been about 50 times this has happened in history. About half of those are Japan, if I recall. You know how many of those had even average returns, meaning 6% average real returns for the next decade? And the answer is zero. So the starting point for the U.S. is poor. Everyone knows that, like you alluded to, and everyone's known that for the last couple of years. Here's the difference. In 2020, the Star Wars fans will say there was a disturbance in the force. And you can link it to either the pandemic bottom, interest rates bottom, or the election, but it happened somewhere in that period. Or if you go back 120 years, 2020 was the worst year ever. If you go back 120 years and you look at value, cheap versus expensive stocks within the U.S. market, the worst year ever was 1999. That was followed by the best year ever in 2000 after the bubble popped. That was until 2020. 2020 was worse than 1999 for value stocks. However, we then saw this disturbance in the force where value stocks crushed it last year. You know, our shareholder yield suite, the U.S. fund was up almost 50% last year. Now, the difference is the really expensive stuff hasn't imploded yet. It started to. A lot of the really expensive growth names have come off. But if we remember back to the late 90s, that's a multi-year process. And so the market cap weighted hasn't rolled over yet. When that does, I think that's when you'll eventually see the carnage. Now, the challenge is, we did a tweet this morning quoting old F. Scott Fitzgerald and said, you know, if you know me long enough, I'm a trend and value guy. And going back long enough, he's like, you know, the test of a first-rate intelligence is, can you hold two opposing views in your head and essentially not go insane? And so the trend is up, and valuations are outrageously high. And that feels like conflict, but it's not. Man, that was a long-winded answer to your question of what's going to happen with foreign. Well, foreign, the same thing happened last year. Value stocks did great in foreign developed. They beat the market cap index. Emerging market value did great. It beat the index as well. A lot of that had to do with China. The bigger question is, when do the foreign indices, which are much cheaper than the U.S., start to outperform the U.S., which historically has been a coin flip? Your guess is as good as mine, but I think 2022, they've got a pretty good chance.
All right, so a ton to unpack there. And I guess let me first say, look, I think we both agree valuations are poor short-term market timing tools, right? But over the longer term, I think it obviously makes sense to pay attention to valuations. And you just referenced the valuations in the U.S. currently. The one thing I'm curious about, though, is we all know the narrative of the Fed supporting financial markets, right? They've kept rates pinned down. They forced investors to take risk, pumped a bunch of liquidity into the system. And so even if valuations are on the higher end, aren't investors betting against the Fed if they pay attention to those valuations right now and, say, lighten up on U.S. stocks? I mean, that hasn't been a great bet over the past several years. So how do you handle that? Or does it go back to what you're saying? You stay with a trend until it doesn't work anymore. I just think it's tough for advisors.
There's three things in this for the advisors listening and what you can do. The first is, historically speaking, and you can look on my Twitter for this, listeners, we posted a chart of it. We say the next decade should have zero real returns. Most of the carnage actually happened in the first 3 to 5 years. And you can look at sort of the kink in the chart. So historically speaking, when you're at a P ratio above 40, which is bubble territory, historically the carnage comes soon. It may not be next month, it's very likely in the next couple of years. So be aware. Second is, certainly you could use trend as a timing indicator. You know, most of our early work and a lot of our foundational work at our firm on allocation strategies involves trend, and our flagship Trinity portfolios are half trend. So a lot of the trend currently is showing a huge overweight to real assets. If you look at our global momentum ETF, it's stock full of commodities and real estate and equities too, no bonds yet. But I do want to touch on one thing, which I think is a misconception. Now, I'm pretty anti-consensus here. We did an old blog post called Stocks Are Allowed to Be Expensive Since Bond Yields Are Low, .. right? And what we went through is we kind of went through this exercise of looking at historically, you know, do stocks perform well when bond yields are low? And the answer to that is yes. But that has historically been entirely because when bond yields were low, historically, stock valuations were also low. And so if you look at all the other sort of coincident economic indicators of why bond yields were low, it's usually because the economy was doing poor, trailing stock returns were terrible, you had high inflation, just everything was yuck, right? So it set the stage for a bull market. That's not what we have now, right? And so if you look at historically speaking, the setup is not the same, right? The setup was entirely because you were buying stocks at a PE ratio of 12, not 40. So I think a lot of people are going to have this false sense of security as interest rates are cranking up right now in the U.S. With inflation. I mean, who knows what it is, but certainly 4%, 5%, 6%. Historically, PE ratios fall off a cliff above 4% or 5%. Right, they start to slide at 3-4, and then above that, we're looking at low teens, certainly not 40. So what's an advisor to do? Certainly move away from the U.S. If you're in the U.S., move away from market cap. Whatever you do, move away from market cap weighted in the U.S. You can certainly move to foreign. You have dividend yields of 4-5% in a lot of these foreign value indices in the U.S., where the second lowest dividend yield ever outside the late 90s. And then, of course, you can think about tactical moves like tail risk and other ideas as well. But there's a lot of things people can do. The worst thing you can do is hang out in good old market cap weighted 60-40.
Well, and I guess on that note, look, you talk to a lot of financial advisors, and I'm curious, for financial advisors who offer globally diversified portfolios, the bottom line is they've underperformed in the eyes of their clients, right? Clients turn on the news, they see the S&P 500 at record highs. They then look at their advisor's portfolio. It doesn't look so good. Now, obviously, you and I know it's the advisor's job to educate clients, right, on the potential merits of diversifying internationally. But it's tough. That underperformance is difficult to deal with. What I'm curious about is, do you have any sense as to whether advisors have sort of capitulated here and have actually moved to overweight U.S. stocks just because they can't take the pain anymore versus what you're suggesting in actually diversifying internationally right now?
Most advisors I know are always overweight U.S. stocks, and good for them this past 10 years, because U.S. stocks have creamed everything else. Pat yourself on the back. I'm highly confident that's not going to be the way the world looks the next decade. And let me give you some perspective. We did a post called The Case for Global Investing a couple years ago on the blog. And there's stat after stat after stat of why you should not just be invested in one country, even a country as exceptional as the U.S. I mean, the market cap weighted in the U.S., you're already putting 60% in one country, which to me is crazy because if you know history, the examples of countries that have outperformed for many periods, you know, Japan is one of my favorites. And I'm not talking about the 80s. I'm actually talking about the early part of the 20th century. Japan, one of the best performing stock markets in the world from 1900 to the 1930s, and then essentially went to zero. And there's a long list of countries that have lost 80 to 100%. And by the way, the U.S. is in that bucket. The U.S. lost 80% plus in the Great Depression. But let me give you a stat. You know, in the 2010s, the U.S. creamed everything else. That was a long period of outperformance. Again, it's a coin flip in any given year. So everyone is extrapolating that into the indefinite future. If you look at when it also outperformed the 90s, you know, when I was certainly graduating university, the U.S. creamed everything else. You know how you have to go far back before that for the U.S. outperforming the GDP weight or equal weight of the world? 1910s, all right? So 80 years prior to that, you know, you went without U.S. outperforming a basic equal weight of the world. So it's an exception rather than the rule. And particularly right now, I mean, not diversifying globally, 75% of the best performing stocks each year are outside the U.S. And you and I kind of went back and forth on this on email a little bit. I think a great example when people talk about international investing is they feel diversified by investing in the U.S. because the U.S. has exposure to foreign revenues. I hear this quote a lot. They say, no, Meb. The U.S. gets 40% of their revenue from abroad, therefore I'm diversified, to which I respond, the U.S. has the lowest percentage of foreign revenues of any country in the world. And if you're a global investor and borders are becoming increasingly meaningless, which they are, there's companies that are domiciled in the U.S. that have zero U.S. revenue, et cetera, then you should be even less inclined to be focused on arbitrary geographic borders and invest everywhere. And the reality is there's about 10 times as many stocks yielding 3% dividends outside the U.S. than inside the U.S. The world is your oyster, a lot of opportunity elsewhere. You know, and that certainly, I think, will be the story over the next decade.
Meb, we only have a couple minutes left here, and I know you and I, we could spend 2 hours talking about this topic, but you just hit on one of the common rebuttals I hear to investing internationally, that the largest U.S. companies do generate a meaningful portion of their revenue and earnings overseas. You address that. The two other common rebuttals I hear to investing internationally are, number one, poor demographics, that if you look at places like Europe and Japan and even now China, the demographics just don't look great for driving productivity and GDP growth. And then the other common rebuttal I hear, I would say especially for emerging markets, is that they're essentially a play on the U.S. dollar. So if the U.S. dollar is weak, great. But if it's strong, that's not a recipe for emerging market success. Do you have any quick thoughts on either of those or both of those rebuttals?
Quick is tough for me, as you know. If you look at demographics, the U.S. is only 25% of world GDP. So most of the world, I love talking about this with specifically to emerging markets. I always try to get people to guess emerging markets as a percentage of world GDP, and they always get it wrong because it's more than half. And if you look at a lot of emerging markets specifically, you know, as far as population growth, as far as, you know, all the long list of things going on, it's almost a slam dunk on why you'd want to be investing in emerging markets. Now, emerging markets are only about 13% of the global equity market cap. The average client invests about 3%. So there's a huge gap. And if you look at valuations, I said the U.S. is at 40, foreign developed is low 20s, emerging is mid-teens, which is cheap already. And then if you look at a value index, like our emerging markets shareholder yield fund, it's sporting like a 4-6% dividend yield, single digit P ratios, right? Like exceptionally cheap. And then you get into the dollar. We could do a whole podcast on this, but you know, historically real currency returns are stable. So obviously they can go up and down 20% a year. If you look what's going on in Turkey, they're, of course, volatile. But over time, they're stable, adjusting for inflation. That having been said, you know, there are moves. The U.S. right now, on a purchasing power basis, is overvalued versus most currencies. So, yes, I think that will be a tailwind rather than a headwind, but who knows, of course. But if anything, you know, if you look at some of these companies and growth in the emerging markets, you know, I think that that'll certainly be a story of the next decade, not necessarily the U.S. You got to remember, the U.S. wasn't always the world's largest market cap country. You go back a couple decades, and Japan was 40% of the world. And guess what? Japan's had zero returns for 30 years post that bubble popping. So the largest big dog in the world is not always the best place to be.
This is just such a fascinating topic to me. I think you saw the chart that I tweeted out from J.P. Morgan that showed just the broad U.S. Stock benchmark has outperformed broad MSCI International over the past 14 years. Yeah. Some, you know, 275% outperformance. It's unbelievable. But Meb, great stuff as always. I really enjoy hearing your perspective on the markets. Certainly wish you all the success in 2022. Thank you for joining me.
All right, bud. Thanks.
That was Meb Faber, CEO and Chief Investment Officer at Cambria Investment Management.